Hi, and welcome to the first NPR Science Podcast of the new year. I'm Christopher Joyce, and today the Science Desk is bringing you this. Coral reefs are suffering. A blind man who sees, the trash that never got taken out, and the adult brain on music. Let's start with the suffering. Coral reefs support some of the most diverse forms of life on Earth. Their loss would wipe out the oceanic equivalent of huge rainforests. Human activity has taken a toll on reefs for decades. Now there's something else to worry about, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Richard Harris spoke with scientists in Australia who are seeing some of the strongest evidence yet that coral reefs are already suffering. And here's his story.
Living corals literally build the reefs. So researchers at the Institute of Marine Science in Australia have taken a close look at corals along the Great Barrier Reef to check on their growth over the past several decades. Glenn Dieth explains they focused on big round corals known as porites.
They lay down the history of their growth in their skeleton, so just like tree rings.
As a result, scientists can measure the rings and see how fast they've been growing. As they report now in Science magazine, coral growth slowed appreciably starting around 1990.
There have been some other studies now which are showing similar effects, but this one covers basically the whole of the Great Barrier Reef, which is over 2,000 miles long. And that's a huge area, and we've found very consistent results.
Growth is slowing by about 1% per year. And if the trend continues, Dieth says this critical species of coral could stop growing entirely across the Great Barrier Reef by the middle of this century. The big question is why this is happening. The scientists point to two factors. One is increasing ocean temperatures, apparently as a result of global warming. Dieth says the other factor is that the ocean has been getting more acidic, also as a consequence of all the carbon dioxide we're pumping into the atmosphere.
So the carbon dioxide dissolves in the water becomes more acidic, and that increased acidity is what reduces the rate of growth of the corals.
That change in ocean chemistry makes it much harder for corals and other shell-building organisms to build their skeletons. I called coral expert Joni Kleipas at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado to ask her about the study. So what does this portend for corals?
Oh, it's not very good, is it? We've predicted this for a long time, and I think most of us would like to be proven wrong, and it seems like this paper is one more notch telling us that maybe this whole problem of climate change in coral reefs is really true, and we need to do something about it.
But what to do is the question. Carbon dioxide is building up rapidly in the Earth's atmosphere as we burn more and more fossil fuels. Even optimistic scenarios find that a whole lot more carbon dioxide is going into the air and the ocean in the coming decades.
It looks pretty gloomy, I have to say it. It looks really gloomy for the Great Barrier Reef, and I think there'll be major changes there.
That's Ron Salm in Hawaii, who advises the Nature Conservancy about coral reef issues. He doesn't share the gloomiest scenario, which is that corals in the Great Barrier Reef could die off entirely by the end of the century, but he expects the reef will soon be a very different place. Salm says, of course, the world needs to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, but we also need to find and preserve reefs that are relatively resilient to the effects of global warming and ocean acidification. For example, there are some areas north of Australia, in the so-called Coral Triangle, that seem to be doing relatively well right now.
We need to put in place actions that we can take today to help safeguard the reef, so that by the time the carbon dioxide emissions are under control and are being rolled back to some acceptable level, that we've got to ensure that there's something that survives.
Presuming we can someday repair our atmosphere, young seaborne corals can then float throughout the ocean and repopulate the reefs. What's coming clear is that in the face of climate change, the conservation challenges for the ocean may turn out to be even more challenging than for ecosystems on land. Richard Harris, NPR News.
We now turn to something strange about the human mind. I think this story is rather profound myself because it addresses an unusual question. What does it mean to see something? This story involves a man who is totally blind, and yet he can use his eyes to navigate at least part of the world. My colleague Joe Palka tells us more.
The story revolves around a physician in his 50s known by the initials TN to protect his privacy. A few years ago, Tien had two strokes, one on each side of his brain. Both strokes were in the part of the brain called the occipital cortex. That's the primary place the brain processes vision. Tien's eyes work just fine, but without the occipital cortex, he had no conscious ability to see. Beatrice de Gelder heard about Tien and decided to explore the nature of his blindness. De Gelder is a Dutch neuroscientist. She says there's no question Tien considers himself blind.
If you would ask him, am I holding something in front of your eyes, yes or no, he will say, I don't see it. I cannot tell whether it's yes or no.
De Gelder believed that Tien might still have some visual function, because even though his brain's primary visual processing area was gone, he still had other visual centers intact. But no matter what tests they tried or what questions they asked, they couldn't find any evidence that Tien could see anything. So they tried something different.
We said rather than asking questions about what he sees or does not see, let's take the big risk of building a little maze in the corridor here and see whether he can navigate that.
So they made a kind of obstacle course and then told Tien to walk down the corridor.
We didn't give any information about obstacles or anything. So he was not aware that there were obstacles.
The obstacles were things like a wastebasket and a stack of papers. There was also a tripod.
They all had different shapes and sizes.
So if he had walked straight ahead, he would have bumped into them.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
But he didn't walk straight.
He never touched any. We were, like, totally amazed.
Because this was after days of testing that confirmed that he had no sight at all. Tien couldn't figure out why the researchers were amazed by what he did.
Since he hadn't seen any obstacle, he was not aware of having achieved anything sensational.
Did he give any explanation for why he didn't walk in a straight line?
No. He was not aware of not walking in a straight line.
Wow. That's amazing. You can see a video of this at npr.org. De Gelder thinks what is happening is the signals from the eyes are being processed by more primitive centers in the brain. After all, having a cortex to process vision is rather a new invention in evolutionary terms. Many animals do just fine hunting prey and avoiding predators with little or no cortex to rely on. De Gelder says many of these old centers still exist in the human brain.
They are still present there and they can be called upon to be used.
It's just they don't provide a conscious experience of seeing things. It may seem odd that our brains could be doing something we're not aware of, but Charles Gross says it really isn't. Gross is a neuroscientist at Princeton University. He says our brains do a variety of things without our conscious control, things like regulating blood pressure or adjusting hormone levels. Gross says something similar is going on with this blind sight.
There is visual information that comes in, it's processed, it's used to control behavior, but you have no conscious access to it.
It's hard for people with normal sight to really understand how this unconscious seeing would work, but it does provide a whole new shade of meaning to the phrase, seeing is believing. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
And then there was the trash that was never taken out. This is not a story of sloth or neglect, rather resolve. 1 year ago, Los Angeles resident David Kamaitis decided he would not take out any trash or recycling for all of 2008.
For the past year, I've been saving all of my trash and my recycling in the basement, not because I'm crazy, but because I realized that when it just sort of leaves the curb and goes away, you don't know how much you have. So I thought, well, I'll see how much I have, and I'll see what kind of changes I can make in the process.
Day to day, checked in with Kamaitis to see what happened.
The entire stairs are covered with, bottles. There are probably 220 bottles, beer bottles. And I've got, I think it's about 51 pounds of paper, 20 pounds of cardboard boxes, cereal boxes. About a 4-pound bag of plastic bags, which is
three boxes, cardboard boxes
of garbage, stuff that would go to the landfill, can't be recycled, can't be reused. And this represents basically 32 pounds, which is my entire year. That's what the average American makes in a week. That's what I created for the year. The hardest thing was just stopping throwing things away, stopping putting things in the garbage, because until you try to stop something like that, you don't realize how sort of ingrained it is in you and you don't think about it. Most of the garbage that I created, I think, was probably from the first, like, 3 to 4 months as I sort of, like, learned about things. And once I sort of took those into my daily routine, it's now just generating 1/2 pound of garbage a month really doesn't take any more or less of my time than normal. It's just my normal everyday existence. I saved all my trash from recycling for a year. And what I'd love for everybody out there to do is just do it for a week. Pick a week within the first 2 weeks of January, say, and save all of your trash and recycling for that week. And then write down what it is. Take a look at it. See what you can get around. See how much it'll change you. You'll be shocked, number one, in how much you create, but also how easy it is to change a lot of your habits. If you can't save your stuff, you live in an apartment or something, just keep a list of it. It's basically accomplishes the same thing. So give it a week. You don't have to do a year. And see what you learn. I think you'll find it's going to be a lot.
You can find out more about this Save Your Garbage for a Week challenge on the Day-to-Day blog, Daydreaming. It's at npr.org/daydreaming. And in your daydreaming, have you ever imagined yourself a world-renowned pianist or commanding the stage in a sold-out concert? But alas, you don't even play an instrument. Well, don't despair. Most professional musicians started out when they were young, but neuroscientists and music teachers alike say it's never too late. As it turns out, the biggest hurdles are not stiffening hands or an aging brain. Bridget McCarthy explains why.
For adults, the urge to play an instrument is often awakened by a great piece of music. For filmmaker David Murdoch, it was a tune called George's Dilemma.
I was probably about 25, and I got really interested in a trumpet player named Clifford Brown. And the more I listened to him, the more I thought, well, maybe I could play this. So I bought a trumpet, and I started teaching myself how to play.
He was living in a tenement building on 109th Street in New York City.
It was hard for me because to really play well, you have to cut loose and blow. So I would do things like blow into the pillow or go into the closet and blow into my clothes. But once in a while, I would really just practice loudly. One day I came home from work. And I found that my door had been totally demolished. The door frame was splintered, and the door was practically ripped off the hinges.
So Murdoch called the cops.
This policeman answered the phone, and I said, my apartment's been broken into. And he said, what'd they get? And I said, well, they didn't get much. But the thing I'm really upset about is they took my trumpet. And he says, oh, play the trumpet, huh? I'm like, yeah. Been playing long? I'm like, you know, a few months, teaching myself. He goes, oh, teaching yourself, huh? Probably one of the neighbors.
And that, Murdoch says, was the whole investigation. He never got another trumpet. He figured that was his last chance to learn it.
A lot of people believe that the brain isn't very plastic after you reach puberty.
Norman Weinberger is a neuroscientist at University of California, Irvine.
In fact, the brain maintains its ability to change. That's plasticity. To take in new information and organize it with old information and do new things throughout lifespan. Now, is it as easy to learn something when you're 65 as it is when you're 5? The answer is no. But can you do it? Yes.
For an adult beginner, it can sometimes feel like trying to learn Arabic and ice skating at the same time. Think about it. When you're hunched over the piano keys or bowing a violin, you're using your muscles and most of your senses, and your brain's working really hard. You're reading the notes on the page, counting out the rhythm, trying to keep a steady beat, and make it sound like music. That's why, unlike language, there's no single music center in the brain. There are lots of them.
When brain scans have been done, actually in musicians, you find the enormity of the areas of the brain that are actually being activated.
Children are growing new brain cells all the time. So when they're learning music, some of those brain cells are devoted to playing their instrument. Adults, on the other hand, have to work with the brain cells they already have and create new connections or synapses between them.
Ability is so low, I think, on the list of what's required.
Scott Hawkins is a piano teacher in Silver Spring, Maryland. He says for his adult students, Attitude is everything, especially patience.
I think often adults come in with these exorbitant, perhaps unrealistic goals about what they want to achieve at the piano and the amount of time they want to achieve this at the piano. We want to skip steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and be at 6.
And unlike children, no one's forcing them to practice. So they never get around to it. But adults have advantages too. They can see and hear things in the music that completely escape children. David Conrad is one of Scott Hawkins' students. He's been taking lessons for several years. When learning a new piece, he spends hours analyzing the music before he sits down to play it. He wants to understand the chords and the rhythm and the structure of the piece to figure out what the composer is trying to say.
I started working on a Scriabin prelude. And one of the things that I have to do when I approach this is I have to be very patient with myself.
David Conrad and his son Simon started piano lessons together when Simon was 8 years old. David wanted his son to see him struggle, but he wasn't quite prepared for the fear.
I played in church one time where I almost fell face forward into the keyboard. What happened? My eyes went blurry. It was like looking through the windshield before the wipers go on. Things like that will happen to me when I'm playing for other people. And it used to happen when playing for Scott, which is totally ridiculous, right? I'm learning from Scott. It took me several years to get over that.
Scott Hawkins says fear of failure is a big issue for his adult students.
We don't want to be seen as incompetent or struggling with a task. Because we're so competent in so many areas of our life, we do so many things so well. To start with something that we don't do well is, I think, is a real challenge.
Still, for those who are willing to practice and settle for something less than virtuosity, there are real payoffs. Playing music is great mental exercise and can keep brain cells alive that would otherwise wither and die. David and Simon Conrad have had their musical setbacks over the years, but they haven't quit. Simon, who's now 16, still takes lessons occasionally. And a few months ago, he started teaching himself the saxophone. His dad learned some jazz chords, so now, when Simon needs a break from his homework, they play duets. It may be hard and humbling, but to play music with someone you love or pursue a lifelong goal can be infinitely rewarding. For NPR News, I'm Bridget McCarthy.
So, we've suffered and seen and resolved and dreamed away another On Science podcast. The Science Desk will be back next week, and in the meantime, thanks for downloading and listening. I'm Christopher Joyce.
Imagine me and you, I do. I think about you day and night. It's only right to think about the girl you love and hold her tight. So happy together. If I should call you up, invest a dime, and you say you belong to me and ease my mind, imagine how the world would be. So very fine. So happy together. See me love nobody but you for all my life. When you're with me, maybe the skies will be blue for all my life. Me and you,
only one for me